Hi everyone, my name is Marilyn Shannon and I am the founder of Reenchant Planet Earth and The Talking Stick. As you know, we have been publishing the newsletter, The Talking Stick, for about a year and a half, and our passion at Reenchant is to share people's stories. And everyone has a story. A bit of someone's life can give somebody else permission to live theirs. And today is no exception. In fact, today we are honored to have our first audio story, which is a very powerful one. Deidre Huey, who is the mother of two lovely boys and the wife of one, she is...
That's a good number.
She is the partner in Dancing Elephants that teaches ethical sales training to ethical salespeople. She is also the founder of The Buzz Builder, which teaches entrepreneurs how to maximize the internet using internet tools to increase their sales and marketing. She has a very powerful story that is something that you'll all want to listen to, and I know that you're going to want to pass it along to other people in your life because it's going to impact you tremendously. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Deidre to start her story and to tell us why she wants to share this with you today, because it is really powerful. So Deidre, thank you for being here today and for sharing your heart with all of us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Where do you want to begin?
I'm not really sure. I think I would like to answer one of your questions, okay, though, which is to share why I wanted to do this. I truly believe that because of where I've come from and the things that I've overcome in my life, I truly believe, or I hope, maybe that's a better word, I hope that by sharing my story that it would maybe strengthen someone else or help someone else to see that there is a light at the end of the tunnel in whatever trauma they're going through, that things can get better even when you are in the deepest belief that it can't and never will, that it can. Because I used to believe that. I used to believe that life was hell and that it was never going to change. There was no hope. And what possible reason would I ever want to think about having a future? Because things were so bleak. So that's why I actually wanted to share my story.
So where are you from originally?
Virginia. Well, originally, I was born in New York. But I consider Virginia because that's where I grew up, first grade on.
And so what was life like in Virginia for you?
It was a beautiful, beautiful place. When we first moved to Virginia, I lived in the hills in Virginia, a little tiny town called Flint Hill. And it was beautiful and quaint, even though at, you know, first years or by first grade, I would never have thought of that word, but that's what it was. It was a very quaint little town. There was one road right through the middle of town. We had one gas station, which we actually live next to. We live next to the gas station. There was one gas station, what was called a corner store, even though it didn't sit on a corner, which always fascinated me as a child, that we called it the corner store. But that was Eileen's. The post office was right between our house and the corner store, and the post office was actually, I swear to you, it wasn't bigger than an outhouse. I mean, you walked in, you were surrounded by mailboxes, two steps into the door, you were standing next to the postmaster. It was very, very tiny little town. And then my parents decided that we were going to be more rural. I don't know how you get too much more rural than that, but they decided they were going to be even more rural and build a house in the woods. So we bought 15 acres of land, and my parents built a house. So we lived in a barn for a little while. It was actually, when we first got there, it was, it was posts with a roof. That was the barn. Completely overgrown, and we had to tear all of that out, snakes and all. And then we ended up living in the barn as my dad put up the slats on the sides of the barn. And then my dad built the house that we eventually moved into.
So you have to help build that house?
I did. I saw it constructed, bit through my tongue, jumping out of one of the windows when I was young because I thought it was really cool jumping in and out. And my dad put the framework up, and he put this one board across the window, and I wasn't able to jump through anymore. Well, I thought, well, that's okay. I'll just jump through the window. And jumped out of the window, missed the trench, and went straight down to the basement and bit through my tongue. So I can do really cool things with my tongue that my kids think is neat.
So that sounds like a lovely time in your life, that time in Virginia, when you got to build that house. And
it did. It was a really neat time in my life. That was early elementary school. I think we moved out to, we used to call it the farm. We had horses and cows and pigs and a lamb named Wallace, named after my third grade teacher, and chickens. And pigs. Did I say pigs? I'm not sure. So we called it the farm, even though it was self-sufficient.
That's a little different than where I grew up in New York.
Yeah, a little different.
So when did things start to change?
My mom opened up a corner store, not a corner store. She opened up a craft store, I guess, a little country store. And actually, that's what it was called. It was called The Country Store. And it was a really cute little store. And I was 12, 11 or 12. I'm not sure exactly how old I was, but I was 11 or 12. And my mom would have me come work at the store. And, you know, I didn't want to always be in the store. And so it wasn't like it was crazy busy. It was out in the middle of the country. So I would go out there was a little parking lot outside, and I would go outside and play with the local kids because everybody else was outside playing. There was an older kid that was there. I didn't realize how old he was at the time, but he was about 18 or 19. And we would play hide and seek. A whole bunch of the kids and I would play hide and seek. Well, at one point we played hide and seek, and it turned out not to be a very good thing.
What happened?
We ended up at this building. He kept saying, come up here. We'll make sure nobody will find us. As we were getting closer to the schoolhouse, I had this feeling that something wasn't right. But, you know, I was very innocent. And I had never felt warning bells before. I didn't know what that meant. I knew that I was feeling uncomfortable, but I didn't quite understand why I was feeling uncomfortable. And by the time we got to the back, and it was actually quite nice at first. You know, it was taking me through the building, and then we got into this one room, and he sat down and pulled me onto his lap, and then I thought, this is not good. I just wasn't sure what was going on, and he started kissing me and touching me, and I started crying. I was trying to push away, and I couldn't get away, and so I started crying. And it was a terrifying moment when he stood up and he said, you know, you can cry, you can scream, you do realize that no one will hear you here.
What was going through your mind?
At the moment, I was scared. I wasn't incredibly scared until he stood up, stormed out of the room, and I had this sense of relief. I thought, well, he's going to leave, because I'd cried so much. He was going to leave. And he came back with a 2x4 and held it over me and said that if I didn't shut up, he was going to kill me. Then I was pretty sure I was going to die.
So yeah. Then what happened?
I fell apart. I realized that he was right. He could kill me and no one would know. And I had no idea when anybody would ever even find me. And I couldn't stop crying. I cried harder when he did that. And then he threw the board down and picked me up and held me, and it was very confusing.
Held you how?
Just like comforting.
Comforting.
Just comforting. And I have to backtrack for just a moment because as beautiful as I painted the picture of where I was growing up, it wasn't always all that beautiful and wonderful. My father was an alcoholic. He's still an alcoholic. And my mom worked a lot. They weren't home very often. And so there was a part of me, and the reason I think this is such a difficult thing for me to understand, there was a part of me that didn't feel connected or close to people. I didn't feel very loved. I actually used to go and hug my dogs. I was so glad I had dogs because we had this one St. Bernard and he was just huge and very comforting. And I would go up to him and I'd hug him and I'd say, you know, at least I know you love me, Stoney. So it wasn't that everything was idyllic. And so there was certainly a part of me when I was held by this guy, even though he just threatened to kill me, there was a part of me that really liked being held. And it made it just that much more confusing.
I think many people have experienced that same kind of confusing emotional roller coaster. And that is why so often we go after something that's negative that feels good, because we associate it with something that feels good. Is this a hard story for you to tell?
It's a very hard story for me to tell.
How long have you been wanting to tell your story?
Oh, I probably didn't get to the point where I could actually tell anybody this story until, probably within the last 10 years.
So before then, you couldn't tell?
I had told individuals. I was certainly in a lot of therapy. That's only the beginning of the story. So I was in a lot of therapy.
Because that's obviously, that was just one instance, but there's more that came from that experience.
Yes.
So this is a big deal for you to sit here today and share this.
Yes, it's a very big deal.
Very big deal. So go ahead, continue.
So after he hugged me and said, you know, it was time to go back, I thought, well, maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Or maybe I was getting scared for no reason. So I was walking back and I took a shortcut, and this is really interesting because this is just how innocent I was. I mean, I took this shortcut back to the store where I was supposed to be. Well, the shortcut just happened to go by, I didn't realize it, but it just happened to go by the sheriff's office. And I didn't know. I didn't realize it was the sheriff's office. Anyway, I walked by the sheriff's office and got back to the store, and this guy, and his name's David. I'm not going to say his last name, but his name was David. So David walks in and he's furious. I'm like, why are you so upset? And he said, what did you tell the sheriff? So I didn't tell him anything. See, now I'm still not understanding something's gone horribly wrong here. I'm still not understanding that what he's done was not a good thing. I didn't get it yet.
So in your mind,
he knew
at that point,
it was a bad thing.
So at that point in your mind, you thought that he was what? Caring about you? Loving,
no,
showing you
I wasn't
emotion?
Sure. I wasn't sure exactly, but being held, I can't tell you the last time I had been held before then. And being held was a very big deal. It was a very, very big deal. I really enjoyed being held, even though he had done, you know, he had touched me and he had kissed me and made me feel uncomfortable. Being held made it all go away. It was, I can't explain it. So I truly was surprised when he came in and thought that I had told somebody, like it was something bad, and I didn't realize yet that it was.
You've expressed this so well that I know that there are many people out here that have had a similar experience thinking, having gone through something like that, and then finding themselves that they didn't even know that it was wrong.
And I think it can happen at any age. I mean, I was young. I know it happens to people that are younger than me. But I believe it's something that can happen to us as adults, especially if we were raised in a situation where we maybe didn't experience love the way we should be able to experience love. And so we get warped perceptions about what that means and what that is. But it's still very difficult to say, because it still brings up a lot of the thoughts and feelings from years ago. I mean, this is something that happened almost 30 years ago. But I don't think about it every day, and bringing it up brings up a lot of emotions.
Well, it's true that when you start out in a kind of a cuckoo kind of way of starting out, your norm, what you believe to be the norm,
it's
completely thrown off, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So getting back to that time, mm-hmm. so he, David, mm-hmm. thought that you had gone in and reported him.
Right.
And then what happened?
Well, I assured him that I hadn't. And he made me promise that I wouldn't tell anybody, which I thought was so silly. I mean, I didn't know why he was so adamant about it. It's funny looking back on it and saying, well, of course he should have been. But I didn't understand. And I didn't understand. I didn't truly understand his intentions. I didn't. This kind of went on for a while. I don't know how many times I ended up at the schoolhouse, but several times. And then one day, I remember when he tried to put his hands into my pants. And then I got spooked again. So the next time he came by the store, I told him I wasn't going. And he said that was fine. He'd come in the store. So he did. He came in the store and told me that I had to jack him off. I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea. I didn't know what that meant. And so he pulled his pants down, and I was like, oh my gosh, just this monstrous thing. I had never seen a penis before. I had never seen one. And, you know, now this man wants me to touch it and do things to him.
It's interesting how we have a natural tendency to think it's disgusting when we don't even know that either.
Yeah.
How would we know that? How do we know
it's
disgusting?
Well, it just didn't look right.
How would you know?
It just didn't look right, yeah.
So you had gone back, you had continuously gone back for more of that affection and attention.
And honestly, the thing I liked the most was just being held.
And then he came in your store and he did that.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah. And then I know this went on for, it gets very cloudy for me at this point. I don't have a lot of my memories. What I do know for sure is that this went on for almost an entire summer, you know, traditional school calendar summer. And I remember towards the end of the summer, I started thinking the hugs weren't enough anymore. There were too many other things happening that made me uncomfortable, that I realized something was wrong. He was beginning to hurt me, and it scared me. And he didn't hug me as much as he did in the beginning. And I wanted it to stop. And I remember telling my mom, and you have to realize, I truly believed he was going to kill me if I told somebody. He mentioned it so many times. I remember being at the house, and my mom told me I needed to go to the store. And I begged her not to send me. I just kept telling her over and over again, please don't make me go, please don't make me go. And she told me all kinds of things about how I wasn't being responsible and I wasn't pulling my weight.
And you were 11, 12?
Yeah. And I, you know, she didn't know what my problem was. And I couldn't tell her. I was sure he would figure it out and he would find me and kill me. I was positive. So I just cried and cried. And eventually she, that one day, because I did it once and she let me not go to the store that week. And then the next week I had to go again. So I went to the store and this was the last time I saw David. He came by the store and told me that he knew that I didn't want to see him anymore, but he just wanted to see me one last time. And then he promised he would leave me alone. And I believed him because I don't know why I believed him, but I believed him.
Oh, that's all. You were a kid.
So he told me to meet him at this house. I went to this house and walked in he picked me up and laid me on this bed and walked me around the house first. But what I remember is the bed and lying me on the bed I don't really want to talk about what he did. I don't know that I can say out loud the things that he did to me.
Share whatever's comfortable.
But it was everything just short of, I still call it rape. I mean, that's why I still call it that. But it was everything short of that. It was everything. The only thing that didn't happen is that his penis didn't go inside of me. But, yeah, I can't. I have all these visuals going on in my head, and I just can't. I can't talk about it. I can tell you that I began crying so hard my body shook, and he stood up and stormed out of the room. And he stormed out of the room in the same way that he did the one time that he came back with a 2x4. And I kept waiting and listening. And I was so quiet in the house. And I kept thinking he's going to come back and he's going to kill me. And I put my clothes on as fast as I could. I was trying to be really quiet. But I grabbed my things and I laughed. And I was never within his presence again. And what I mean is, I would be on a bus and we'd stop somewhere and I would see him and he'd watch me from a corner or what have you. He was always watching. It's a very small town. You can't get away from people. But that was the last time. I was very glad to be alive. I didn't realize how lucky I was until I was in therapy years later, actually not that many years later, and he was actually convicted of raping a girl at gunpoint. He was in prison. So they think that I may have been, if not his first, one of the first few women that he ever abused. Yeah.
Wow. Quite a story. And it goes on from there.
Yeah. Life kind of sucked for a while. It really did. It really did. That it really messes with your psyche, first of all. And the way I thought about life, and I started this downward spiral. And it finally ate at me. The story of what had happened ate at me so much that I went for almost a week without sleeping.
Now, and that was right after... The thing that really triggered it was when he actually took you into that house.
Yeah.
And got you into the bed.
And then I told my mom I didn't care what she did. I was never, ever going back to the store.
And at that point, you hadn't told her?
No. No.
So for a week, you didn't eat, you didn't sleep?
Mm-mm. No, I was falling apart. So I went to my mom. I went to my mom, and I told her I had to tell her something. And so she asked me to tell her, and I told her that this guy had molested me at the store and around the store, and that that's why I didn't want to go back. And I was crying. And part of the reason I wanted to tell her is because she was thinking horrible things about me, and it wasn't that I, you know, didn't actually want to work in the store or didn't want to do whatever she wanted me to do, but I just couldn't put myself through that anymore. So anyway, I told her this story, and looking back now, it's unfathomable, but at the time, when I finished my story, I was anticipating action. Something.
From your mother.
Sure. Something to know that, you know, what I was thinking was wrong really was. And my mom said to me, "What do you want me to do?"
Deidre.
And I just kind of turned my head to the side and I looked at her and I said, "What?" She says, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And I thought for a second, and in that second, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, gosh, maybe it's not as big of a deal as I thought it was. Maybe I'm making a big deal out of nothing. What? I mean, my mom's not going to do anything. So I said, "Well, nothing." And she said, "Well, okay." And that really messed with me.
I bet it did. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking to myself, had your mother been molested?
I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
Because her norm was off.
Yeah.
So I was also sitting here when you were saying that, and I felt my body just want to collapse. When, you know, if I was standing there in your position and she said that to me, I would have gone like, what do you do now?
Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I began to not trust myself, not trust the way I thought, not trust my instincts, and became very introverted, went into a deep, dark, nasty depression. By the time I got into ninth grade, I was suicidal. I was suicidal, and I was planning my suicide. And it was just such a dark, dark time, and I didn't see... I mean, my parents weren't happily married, and life just sucked. I mean, it was just horrible and bleak, and I couldn't imagine why anybody would want to have children, and because life was hell, and why would you bring children into hell? I never wanted to get married. I absolutely did not want to get married because everybody I knew was divorced and miserable. And I didn't know what love was. But I had one friend when I was in fifth grade. Her name's Diane. Oh my gosh, she is just wonderful. We're still friends today.
And I guess having one friend, one connection to something outside of where you were, which I guess for anybody, having just something to hold on to can make all the difference in the world.
Yes, and I think that it's one of the reasons I was able to hang on as long as I did. But I didn't see her and her mom nearly as often as I really needed to. And as wonderful and comforting as it was to be there, there was also a part of me that I think every time I went there, I was more and more removed from the reality of their reality. It's hard to explain.
So unreal.
Yeah, their life became more and more unreal to me.
So after you told your mother what had happened to you, she never brought it up again?
Never. No. No, never brought it up again. Ever.
Interesting.
Mm-mm. Now, as an adult, I brought it up to her once, but...
What was her reaction?
She doesn't remember. She doesn't remember that happening.
So, were you, during that period of time, after you told her and nothing made any sense...
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, your feelings didn't make sense. Your ideas didn't make sense. Nothing made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this friend.
Yeah, well, I guess you were saying, you know, there's no glimmer of hope. And there was this glimmer, but eventually it didn't make a difference anymore. I started losing more and more and more hope. And so, you know, It's hard to explain.
Well, what happened the day your mother actually said, "What do you want me to do?" What happened to you that day?
I felt completely alone. That if anybody was going to take care of me, it needed to be me, and I felt incredibly alone.
So you were alone.
Yeah.
So. What did you do to get yourself to where you are today? Because you're someplace.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a powerful woman today.
Yeah, thank you.
With a lovely family, with a husband, with children, two businesses. I mean, you're well known. People love you. How did you go from that scared little girl?
I can tell you I never would have imagined it. I never, ever would have imagined it. And I had tried to end my life, so I ended up in a psychiatric institution, and, you know, under what they call the highest level of security you can go into a psychiatric institution. It wasn't so much they worried about me hurting other people, they worried about myself hurting me. So I had to have somebody within an arm's reach of me 24 hours a day. So if I was sleeping, I had somebody within an arm's reach. If I was going to the bathroom, I had somebody within an arm's reach. It was very interesting. And at the same time, incredibly comforting. I felt safe for the first time in my life that I could remember back, as far back as I could remember. I felt safe and that I was going to be taken care of.
Well, you were being taken care of.
And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. I loved the institution.
Well, it's no different than loving being initially taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
It showed, I mean, as wacky as it can look.
Yeah.
I mean, having somebody be affectionate towards you, no matter how it looks, no matter where it looks, when your norm is not the norm, it can be rewarding. It can be comforting. It can be loving. It was... That's why people like prison.
Yeah.
That's why people go back to prison. It's the only family they got.
Right. So eventually I was worked my way out of being in this institution.
How long were you there?
I was there for 14 weeks. 14 weeks. And the good thing is that I was self-admitted. And what is so good about that is that they couldn't force medication on me because they wanted to heavily medicate me, and I truly did not want to be medicated.
And how old were you then?
I was, let's see, how old was I when I went to the institution? I think I was 15 or 16.
So you went from the age of 11, 12 to 16, holding a big thing in your heart.
Yeah.
And then you try to kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody finds you?
Well, I had written a note on my hand. On the palm of my hand, I wrote, suicide is not a love of death, but a love for peace. And my mom found it on my hand. And my mom did a good thing, and she sent me to a therapist. But anyway, she saw this on my hand, and so I had started going into therapy right at the crux of my deciding that I was going to end my life. And I had, I don't know how many times I had seen her, maybe five times. And on my fifth time, or however many it was, I don't remember. And my doctor looked at me and she said, we used to call it, she asked me to describe what suicide was. And I said, in my head, you mean? And she said, yes. And I said, suicide is a friend that sits in a chair in my head. And the chair gets closer and closer to me. And someday, I will be able to touch my friend's hand.
So that was something you were looking forward to.
I was. Wow. And when I came in on this one occasion, she looked at me and she just knew. She was amazing. She just knew. And she said, how close is your friend? And I said, I'm pretty sure we're going to be hugging tomorrow. She was the one that convinced me to admit myself into this hospital. Yeah, she saved my life.
So you come out.
Yeah, come out and jump right back into the mess that got you there in the first place. Fortunately, I was a little bit older. I ended up leaving home. I went and lived with my Aunt Robin for a little while. I moved up to Connecticut. Fell in love, I thought. It was not love, but I thought I was in love. And I moved with him down to Orlando, Florida. I did a lot of drugs, during that time. And just still in a little bit of a downward spiral.
Did you stay in therapy?
Not while I was in Florida, no. And then I left, we left Florida together and moved to North Carolina. We lived in Hickory. After just a few months in Hickory, I left him. And I'm missing a piece here with all the drugs and everything else. This guy had actually raped me twice in our relationship. And I stayed, craziest thing. But when we moved to North Carolina, I left him. And I didn't leave him because he was abusive in any way. I left him because he was cheating on me. He started sleeping with someone else. We were engaged. And I found out that he was sleeping with somebody else. And I picked up everything I had, and I moved out.
Would you say that this was a time when you were just defining what love really was?
I think when we moved to Hickory was a much slower pace. The good thing was we didn't have the drug connections anymore. So I was coming out of my haze and starting to realize that I didn't really know who I was. And when he slept with this other woman, I realized I didn't know who he was either. And I just wanted to get away, and I wanted to figure out who I was. I started asking myself questions. It was funny because I moved out and I had nothing. I moved into this cheesy apartment. It was horrible. It had wicker basket hanging from the ceiling, and it had shag carpet and wood paneling on the walls. I mean, it was really horrid. It really was. But I was so excited. I remember walking around the apartment, turning on the lights, going, yeah, that's my light. That's my light. And I had never had a my light before. So it was a very exciting time. And then I went to the store because I didn't have any music. I had nothing. And this was a very defining moment for me. This is why I'm bringing it up. I went to the store and I realized that every piece of music that I picked up, that I wasn't sure if it was what I liked. I knew it was something that somebody else liked. that maybe my father liked it or my mother liked it, or it was something that my ex-fiancé liked. And I wasn't sure what I liked. And I walked out of the store not buying a thing. And I remember that being just very, very significant. And I was bound and determined to figure out what I liked. Because I didn't know. I did not know what I liked. I didn't know who I was.
I guess the thing that I'm so curious about when I'm listening to this is, why you? Why? What was it about you that you were able to, that kept you on the path, kept you strong, kept you, gave you some kind of glimmer? What was that?
I would say that it's the exact opposite of what it was that was driving me downhill before then, which was that I had hope.
Where'd you get it from?
I truly believe that I got it from Dr. Carol Hertz. And I'll tell you what happened when, and this is significant. I can't believe I didn't bring this up before. I told her that the only way I would go to the hospital is if she agreed to come see me.
This is your doctor.
This is my doctor. And she said to me, she said, I can't make that promise because it's against their policies. She says, but I will do everything I can to make sure it happens. And then she asked me if I'd agree to go on those terms, and I went. She came and saw me every single week. I don't know what she worked out with them.
Yeah.
But she came. Oh, this is making me emotional.
This is making you what?
Emotional.
Go ahead. It's okay.
She, I had never had anybody put forth the effort for me before then. So she gave me a hope that not everybody was self-serving, that I could be cared about, that I was a worthwhile person. She gave me hope.
You know, I'm sitting here, and you have just defined for me a concept that I have always had, I could always say, but I didn't always really experience for myself, but I knew to be true. And people often say that, you know, negative stuff, negative emotion, negative stuff, the negative pull is so strong. But the positive is stronger. And sometimes it's so hard for us to go to the positive because the negative seems so strong. However, in the midst of all that darkness, that one little trickle of love, compassion, was enough to pull you out of the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Just that one little trickle in the amongst the forest of darkness, you were able to get through it. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is.
That's how powerful love is.
Mm-hmm.
That's how powerful something positive is. It just takes a trickle.
Mm-hmm.
To hold on
and
to.
And somebody to care.
Wow. Yeah. So.
I ended up moving out to California, out to La Jolla. I started taking much better care of myself.
You know, it's so amazing to sit here, and the first thing I was thinking about was how somebody who went through so much so young, who started denying any of their feelings, any of their intuitions, any of their anythings, could then start to be so clear and to start listening so well to those inner voices.
It's amazing what you can start doing for yourself once you start taking care of yourself. Because it was once I started taking care of myself, I started treating myself to nicer things and realizing it was okay to feel good, and I liked it. And I think that that's where that comes from. When you actually start treating yourself well and accepting that it's okay to feel good, it's easier to start listening to those, the good things.
So now let's imagine that you're sitting here and there's several people out here listening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And they've listened to your story. Some people are sitting on a big story of their own.
Sure.
Some people are just engrossed in the conversation because it's interesting. Maybe somebody's passed this along to a niece, a nephew that's going through some hard times, darkness. Maybe somebody who feels like it just is never going to get any better. It just has not. And they're an adult by now, maybe.
Sure.
So talk to those people. What could you say?
Wow. I think it really speaks back to the reason why I wanted to do this in the first place. It's, I believed for so long that it would never get better, that life was only out to get me, that I could never have a good life. I believed it so, so very deeply. And there were people around me telling me, it's not always going to be like this. It's not always going to be like this. And I just didn't believe them. I truly didn't believe them. Well, first of all, their life didn't stink. So how could I believe them? And so it was one of the reasons it was so important to me and important for me to tell as much of my story as I could to let you know that I know mine isn't the worst story. I know people have had darker times. But I also know how dark it can get. And by expressing my story, I'm hoping that people will see that you can get past it, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It may take you a while to find it, that people really, truly do care about you. I hope that if someone hears this and they're in that darkness, that they realize that it can, that they somehow, some way, they can grab onto some piece of hope, that their life can get better, that their life can change.
Well, you know, there are people who start off with things going pretty okay, and then something happens, and they go into the darkness, but they've had something good.
Mm-hmm.
They've had something, you know, positive. You had from early on, had a lot of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't even know what light looked like.
No. And now there probably isn't a day that goes by that I don't laugh. I love my life. I have an amazing husband, two beautiful children. I have amazing friends. I have an incredible support system around me. People that love me, people I love, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place to be.
And so now you understand what love is.
Real love, yes.
Real love.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more than hope for everyone.
I truly believe that. Yeah, I really do.
You know, sitting here knowing who you are and knowing what it took for you to talk about this in this way, I truly know that you want to get this message out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's important. I hope that it's important to somebody. I hope that it makes a difference for somebody. Yeah.
So in our final moment, is there anything else that you would like to share, ask, tell, anything? It's your moment.
My moment.
Your moment. Yours and everyone that's listening. It's your moment.
You know, I guess it's interesting because I guess I'd like to share this one thing. After my husband and I got married, and he is just wonderful. His name's Sean. After we got married, we got pregnant with our first son. And I think I've told you the story, but this part's very interesting to me. He was born at 24 weeks and 2 days. He was a pound and a half, and he was supposed to die. We were told he was going to die. And what's interesting to me, and he's fine now, obviously, he's 11, and he's beautiful and just wonderful, is that during that time, I had so many people that would come up to me as he was getting better, but I'd run into people and they'd say, I'd ask them, how are they? Oh, well, you know, Jimmy fell down and broke his leg. And I'm like, oh, and she says, oh, well, you know, it's nothing compared to what you're going through. And you know what's interesting about that is that if that's the worst thing that's happened to you, if the worst thing that has happened to you is that, you know, your son has broken his leg and you've never broken your leg, or no one else around you has ever broken their leg and your son just broke his leg, that is huge. That is a huge deal for you. It is enormous. It is the most devastating thing for you. So your devastation at that happening is the same level of devastation I'm going through with my son almost dying in the hospital. It's the same. You know, and so many people like to put these categories on it. Well, you don't understand because you've been through this. Well, it doesn't matter, because your emotions, the level that I feel love for my husband and someone else feels love for their husband, they may be different in categories. But if I love my husband deeply and you love your husband deeply and we feel that, then it's just as intense in your world as it is in my world.
You know, that's a big lesson that you got to learn from your experience as a child, with your emotions and your situation being minimized. Had your emotions and that situation experience been received in the manner in which it occurred, in the level of importance, you would have known that. But your journey has taken you to that place now where you can respect emotion, period. So if we all can get real.
Yeah, and don't downplay when somebody tells you something that's exciting to them or devastating to them, or whatever emotion that they come to you with, that we need to accept that that's their reality.
Or even ourselves.
Absolutely.
Not to poo-poo how we're feeling. I mean, giving ourselves value, mm-hmm. with every step of the way.
Absolutely.
Every step of the way. Well, so thank you so much, Deirdre, for bringing the story out in the open. I mean, how do you feel now by doing this?
Well, I feel better now than when we started. I mean, very honest with you. When we first started, I was very, very nervous and anxious. But now that it's done and I've told it, I feel relieved and hopeful that it'll help someone.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
We'll see you again soon. Bye.
I'd like to take this last moment to thank Deirdre for sharing her story with us. And for all of you out there, please take this opportunity to listen to the story again, to pass it on to family and friends, to share it with your children. It's an important story. And I also invite you all to please contact me at Marilyn@reenchantplanetearth.com and share your story. We'll do video stories, we'll do audio stories, we'll take your story handwritten, any way you can give it to us. And please visit us at www.reenchantplanetearth.com and take a look at some of the stories that we have archived. And on January 14th, Deirdre will host an iCircle. This is an opportunity for everyone to call in and talk to her about her story, share your stories, and we can take as many people as possible on the line. So watch your mail for further directions. Come visit us on our website at www.reenchantplanetearth for the time and for the location and the phone number. Thank you all very much for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.